You will find your text this morning in our bulletin, Isaiah chapter 8, verses 5 through 10. You'll also need your Bible handy because we'll be in the New Testament before we're done this morning. But our text is found in our bulletin this morning, and you'll want to follow along with me as I read Isaiah chapter 8, verses 5 through 10. The Lord spoke to me again. Because this people have refused the waters of Shiloah that flow gently, and rejoice over Rezin and the son of Remaliah. Therefore, behold, the Lord is bringing up against them the waters of the river, mighty and many, the king of Assyria and all his glory. And it will rise over all its channels and go over all its banks, and it will sweep on into Judah. It will overflow and pass on, reaching even to the neck. And its outspread wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. Be broken, you peoples, and be shattered. Give ear, all you far countries. Strap on your armor and be shattered. Strap on your armor and be shattered. Take counsel together, but it will come to nothing. Speak a word, but it will not stand. For God is with us. Beginning back in chapter 7, we saw Isaiah pleading with King Ahaz, the king of Judah, to trust in the Lord and not in foreign alliances. And we found at the beginning of that chapter that Isaiah met with Ahaz, the king, as he was inspecting the water supply for the city of Jerusalem. He was doing so in preparation for a siege, recognizing that Jerusalem could soon come under siege and be faced with adversaries. It's important that we understand the water situation in Jerusalem if we are to understand our text today. We see in verse 6 the phrase, waters of Shiloah that flow gently. Now this is a description of the main water supply for Jerusalem during the time of King Ahaz. And it also is going to serve to be a description of the Davidic line of kings. Just hold on with me for a moment. We'll make that clear. Shiloah is a stream that branches off of the river Gihon. And it's a branch that comes into Jerusalem. It is a slow but steady source of water. Now, Jerusalem is an easily defensible city, positioned where it is. But as a military fortress, it had one flaw, one fatal flaw. Its water supply comes from this above-ground source, this stream of Shiloah that branches off of the Gihon and comes into the city. And because it's above ground, it could be easily dammed up and stopped by an adversary. Now that is why Ahaz was inspecting his reservoirs. He was checking that the city would have enough water to last a long siege. Now secondly, in this context, and something that would have been recognizable to all the people reading this, the fact that Shiloah is need is a description of the Davidic rule. King David was crowned at this place where the Gihon River branches off to the Shiloah, where it came into Jerusalem. And other kings were crowned here at the same place. And so a mention of Shiloah would be a reminder of the Davidic lines of kings. Now it's important for us to recognize that because the main threat that is coming against Jerusalem is from those people to the north, people who were Israelites who broke off after the death of Solomon, people who abandoned following David as king, people who would not follow the son, Rehoboam, who was the son of Solomon, and went and established their own king. Peoples who now are aligning themselves with Syria and want to take over Jerusalem so they can stand against the Assyrians. This is the main threat. This is the problem that Jerusalem is facing. This is the problem that Ahaz is facing. And this is what Isaiah is addressing in this text. And the fact that there are two meanings here both apply to what we're going to look at today. Now we need to identify this people in verse 6. It's somewhat ambiguous. And there's been a lot of discussion over the years. There have been some people who have said, well, this people are referring to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the people of Judah that Isaiah is addressing this letter to. Now that would be somewhat strange for this people to be the inhabitants of Jerusalem, because this people are peoples who are rejoicing over Rezin and rejoicing over the son of Remaliah. They're rejoicing over the leaders of Syria and the leaders of Ephraim. And that's not something that the Jerusalemites would have done. That's not something that the Judites would have done. Instead of rejoicing over those people, they actually would have been in fear of them. Those are the adversaries that are perched against them. And so this people probably in this context refers to the people of the northern kingdom. It belongs to the Ephraimites. It belongs to the people of Samaria. This people. And this people have refused the waters of Shiloah. This people have refused the Davidic kingdom. This people have rejoiced in their own leaders instead of rejoicing in the provision of God in the Davidic kingdom. It is this people who have refused the Davidic kingship. And it is this people who have chosen to worship idols instead of worshiping the true God at His temple in Jerusalem. Well, one of the first things that Jeroboam did after he split from the people in Judah, he said, you know what, if I don't deal with the religion problem, these people are going to go back. And they're going to go back to Judah. Because Jeroboam knew that the temple was in Jerusalem. The place to worship God was in Jerusalem. So Jeroboam set up two idols. Two idols made of gold. And he told the people, these are your gods. You go worship them in these places instead of going to Jerusalem. And so this people have refused the waters of Shiloah. They have refused the provision of God in providing a king. They have refused the provision of God in providing a temple. They have refused the direction of God. And they've gone after idols. And they've gone after other kings. This people. And this people, because they have done that, they are going to have the onslaught of the Euphrates River. When it says, the waters of the river, mighty and many. That's the Euphrates. And it's from that direction that the king of Assyria is going to come. And as Isaiah has been telling us all along in chapter 7 and chapters 8, Syria and Ephraim, Syria and the northern kingdom, are going to fall to the Assyrians. And all along, the people of Judah, the people of Jerusalem, have needed to just trust in God. Don't try and make foreign alliances. Don't try and make an alliance with Syrians. Don't try and make an alliance with Ephraimites. Don't try and make an alliance with Egypt. Just trust that God is going to provide. God is going to provide His provision gently, and He's going to do it in such a way that they don't need to fret. That's what they need to do. See, the Assyrian onslaught is going to destroy those people of the north. It is going to come into the land. It is going to reach all the way up to the neck. We find that later in the book of Isaiah with Hezekiah. That Hezekiah has to deal with this Assyrian threat after the northern kingdom has fallen. And Hezekiah does what Isaiah says to do. Hezekiah trusts in God. And the Assyrian army destroys itself. And the king of Assyria goes back and is killed by his advisors. And that threat is no more. Simply by trusting what God is doing. Trusting in the waters of Shiloah that flow gently. Trusting in the provision of God that God provides. Yes, the waters might come right up to the neck. Might come right up to the neck, but God's going to provide. You are reminded when I read that. Read about the waters reaching up to the neck. I'm reminded of the time I was down in Slidell, Louisiana, following Hurricane Katrina. And my work as a chaplain there, in the 2 weeks I was there, and I'm not exaggerating here, I probably got to minister to 200 to 300 people per day as a chaplain. The need was so great. And I remember one man. You know, a lot of those just kind of blurred together, but I remember this one man. He was somebody that I'll never forget. And he had scabs. His head was shaved, about like Justin's back there. His head was shaved. And he had scabs all over the top of his head. And he told me how he got those. He said, "I was in my home, and the waters came up. And I went up on the second floor, and the waters came up. And I went up in the attic. And I pressed my head up as high as it would go in the eave of that house. And the roofing nails came down. And I could taste the blood at first coming down. But the waters rose and rose." And he says, "The whole time I'm praying. And the waters came up and up and up. And I realized that I was going to drown there. And the waters came up to the level of my lower lip. I stood there and I said, 'God, take me gently.' And the waters began to recede and came down." And he could stand there and he could talk to me. He could tell me his story of what had happened to him. And I could minister to him that day. Never forget him. Never forget that. Never forget the visual of where those nails had pushed. I can imagine him just pushing his head up into the corner of that house as far as he could, even with the pain of nails penetrating his scalp. And here's what is going to happen to Judah. The waters are going to come. The waters of the Euphrates, the waters of the Assyrians are going to come even up to the neck. But God is going to deliver. God is still going to be with them. And he reminds them, "Oh, Emmanuel, God is with us. He is still going to be there." And so this people, the people of the northern kingdom are going to be destroyed. The people of Judah are going to be delivered after a great amount of worry, having the water come up to the neck. But also the destroyers are going to be destroyed. The Assyrians are going to be destroyed. That's what verses 9 and following are talking about. The Assyrians are going to be broken. That's what it's talking about there. The people who have come and are going to conquer. They might strap on their armor, as they have done many times. That's why that's repeated. They've strapped on their armor and they've succeeded. They've strapped it on their armor and they've succeeded. But this time they're going to strap on their armor and be shattered. They're going to strap on their armor and they're going to be shattered. They are going to come to nothing. They are going to speak a word against God and against His people, but it will not stand, for God is with us. The Emmanuel, the God is with us. God's people are going to stand. Their neighbors are going to fall. The destroyers are going to fall. And so in just a very few short verses, Isaiah has dismissed the Assyrian threat. And all that Ahaz and the people of Judah need to do is sit back and watch God's deliverance. Now, Ahaz isn't going to do that. It's going to happen later under the reign of Hezekiah. But Ahaz had an opportunity. Ahaz has had an opportunity just to sit back and watch God work. Sit back and let God be with us. Instead, he was one of the wicked kings. I want us to recognize today that what our passage really says, we get to the bottom of it, we get to the heart of our passage, is that anyone who stands against God will be shattered. Anyone who trusts in God will be delivered. And that message extends beyond the 8th century B.C. It extends beyond the Assyrian threat. It extends beyond the political wranglings of Ahaz's day. That is a message that resonates in every culture, in every nation, in every time. Anyone who stands against God will be shattered, and anyone who trusts in God will be delivered. But you know, we need to be We need to be delivered in a special way. These people are going to be broken and shattered. In order for us to be delivered, we need to be broken as well. And we're going to talk about this more next week. We're going to look at a passage that's quoted so often next week in the New Testament. It took all of the self-control I could muster not to jump into some of those New Testament verses to make this point, because Isaiah is making this one single argument throughout. But I reserve that for next week. But there is one New Testament passage I want us to look at today, and that's in Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, be found on page 809 if you're using the Pew Bible. But Matthew chapter 5, I want to read the first five verses of this chapter. Now we recognize this as being the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. You know, the Sermon on the Mount is probably the greatest sermon ever preached. It was certainly given by the greatest preacher to ever live. I remember in my preaching class in seminary that we examined this sermon. And the one thing that really sticks in my mind is what my preaching professor said. He says, you know what? If you read the Sermon on the Mount in a normal conversational tone, it takes 18 minutes. He says, look at that. The perfect sermon is 18 minutes long. He said, and trust me, none of the rest of you are going to preach a perfect sermon. Okay? Jesus preached a perfect sermon here. And we begin looking at the first five verses. Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. Seeing the crowds, he, that is Jesus, went up on the mountain. And when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Now, Jesus here, when he says blessed, he's talking about these are the people who are going to experience God's blessing. These are the people that God is going to bless. They need to exhibit these characteristics. And he starts right up front with one that we might think is particularly strange. He begins with, blessed are the poor in spirit. Or we might say, blessed are those who are spiritually impoverished. These are the ones who recognize that they have no spiritual strength in themselves. They have no spiritual vitality in themselves. They are totally impoverished spiritually. They're running on empty spiritually. There is no gas in the spiritual tank. And Jesus says that those are the ones who are blessed. Now, of course, self-righteous people are going to consider their tanks are full, maybe even overflowing. Self-righteous people are not going to consider themselves to be spiritually impoverished. Self-righteous people are going to say, hey, God, look at me. Look how good I am. What we're talking about here, Jesus says true blessing, kingdom blessings, come to those who are spiritually impoverished, those who know their tanks are empty. You ever get up in the morning and say, I don't know if I can face another day, I don't know, God, if I've got it in me? Well, it could be that you're actually blessed because you are poor in spirit. You are spiritually impoverished. You know you have no strength in yourself. You know you can't count on anything that comes from yourself. And you recognize just how far away you would be from God if it wasn't for His work in your life. See, these are the people who cry out, Lord, have mercy upon me, a sinner. See, the only way that you can have the kingdom of heaven, the only way you can enter into the presence of God, Jesus says right at the beginning here, is to admit your spiritual poverty. This is a brokenness by choice, and not the type of brokenness that is forced on people as we see in our text in Isaiah. This is a brokenness that says, woe is me, I'm undone. Have mercy upon me, a sinner. Now this brokenness also mourns. Blessed are those who mourn. And what are we mourning over in verse 4? Ho Rightfully, we're mourning over the brokenness of ourselves and the world that we live in. We look around and we know that something isn't right. Now, you don't have to read the paper much or look at the TV news much and see that something just isn't right. And it's that way on all levels. I don't care whether it's things happening across the world or things happening across the street. There is brokenness all around us. Something is not right. And sometimes it's quite ludicrous. Our city right now is facing a crime problem, unlike one we've seen in recent years. And what does the Chamber of Commerce do? Gives our mayor an award for public safety. Come on, folks. Something is broken. Something's not right. And you know, I use that as an example, but it's on every level.
There's a lot of stuff.
Nationally, internationally, in our state, everywhere, brokenness. There's also brokenness inside us as well. See, we must mourn our sin. We must mourn the sin of our neighbors. We must mourn our national sin. We mourn knowing that our sin and its consequences are signs that we are not right with God. And in our mourning, in our brokenness, we discover comfort from Him. We're not going to receive comfort from God until we first mourn over our sin. Until we first recognize our own brokenness. And then we see the blessing that comes to the meek. See, all these things are related. Everything that Jesus says is related. This whole Sermon on the Mount has interrelated themes running throughout it. The blessing that comes to the meek. Now, I want you to recognize that meek does not mean weak. There is a strength in meekness that the world will never understand. Now, the best way we can describe meek is to recognize that Jesus was described as being meek and humble. But I want you to know that the strongest person who ever walked this earth was Jesus. There is nobody to compare to Him for strength. And yet He was meek. He was dependent upon the Father. His strength came from the Father. His strength was ordained by the Father. And it was a strength in humility. It was a strength that doesn't crush. It was a strength that doesn't overrun. It was a strength that led by example. And in the same way, in our brokenness, we recognize that our strength comes from God. It isn't inherently something that comes from within us. This is a strength that will conquer the earth. This is a strength that will possess the earth. It comes from humbly trusting in God and knowing that our strength comes from Him. And so we must be broken. God is going to break. If we don't want to be broken by God, we must be broken before God. We must be broken in our humility. We must be broken in our spiritual poverty. We must be broken in mourning over our sin. We must be broken in our meekness. And so we see in our passage in Isaiah that those who stand up against God, those who consider themselves to be strong, will be broken under His hand. It's only the people who are going to trust in Him who are going to be delivered. As Jesus has taught us in the Sermon on the Mount, we also need to beware of being broken in our pride. We need to beware of being broken because of our sin. Instead of trying to stand strong, we need to humble ourselves before Him, and that's where we're going to actually gain strength. See, just like the people of Isaiah's day, we must not despise and refuse the gentle waters that He brings into our lives. Waters of grace and mercy and love. And if we refuse those gentle waters that He provides, then the torrent of the waters of judgment will rise up and consume us and sweep us away in the flood. See, the people of the northern kingdom refused to follow God's anointed king. And they were carried away by the Assyrians. The Assyrians refused to be humbled by God, and God took them out of the picture as well. And so, as I have repeatedly said in these messages, God continually did that in history and replaced one kingdom with another. There was no kingdom too big to fail. That probably is a good thing for us to remember these days as well. So the people of the northern kingdom refused to follow God's anointed king. They were carried away by the Assyrians. If we refuse to follow God's King of Kings, the Lord Jesus, then we will be swallowed up in judgment as well. These are not just words for people that lived a long time ago in a foreign place. These are words that are important for us as well today. Only as we recognize our spiritual poverty, only as we mourn for our sin, only as we become meek and humble in His presence, and only as we seek only His strength, will we be able to stand in the judgment. See, we are going to be broken. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Every single one of us will be broken. We are either going to be broken by God's judgment, or we're going to be broken by His love and avoid judgment. We must be broken. I hope today that we're broken in knowing our spiritual poverty. I hope we're broken in knowing our need for Christ and Christ alone. And only as we are broken in that way will we experience His grace and the salvation that is found only in Christ. So will we choose to be broken today? Or will we choose to eventually be broken on the anvil of His judgment?